Welcome to Art Focus. I am your host, Wendy Webb, standing in for the lovely Ava Lake. Today we are spending time with local artist Nathan Sandberg. Nathan is a part of a fantastic show at Bullseye Gallery called Invisible Cities. Other artists in the show are Richard Parrish, Jeffrey Sarmiento, and Carrie Iverson. Invisible Cities is showing at Bullseye Gallery till September 25th. Invisible Cities is a show inspired by the novel by the same name by Italian author Italo Calvino. The novel is a series of short stories whereby Marco Polo tells the Emperor Kublai Khan about 55 different cities that he's traveled to. Through Marco Polo's descriptions of the cities, Calvino explores how our experiences are shaped by the places we inhabit and the way invasion, creation, desire, memories, decadence, and the mundane and decay exist in the very structure of every city. We're going to read some passages from the novel throughout the interview to give listeners a sense of this really beautiful novel. Nathan has been working with glass for 11 years, and he also teaches classes on working with glass in art at Bullseye Glass Company. And he has three solo works in the show and also collaborated with Carrie Iverson on a really extraordinary piece called Synchronicity, which we'll discuss more later. So welcome to the show, Nathan.
Thanks, Wendy. It's great to be here.
And so tell me, how did you get into working with glass?
I think originally it was just my curiosity taking over. I had always seen objects made out of glass, whether they were blown or kiln cast or some sort of process that I had no idea about, and I just wanted to learn about it. And around that time in my life, I was actually in a ceramics program in community college, and those two materials aren't entirely different from one another, both in how you work with them and kind of what they're made of. So curiosity kind of took over. I took my first class and eventually left the ceramics behind and picked up glass blowing. And since then, I've even gone even further and left that behind. And now I just focus on working with glass in a kiln.
And so, and you mostly work with kiln-formed glass.
Kiln-formed glass, that's correct.
And so, and I think when I think of glass and art, I think of sculpture. And we had talked a little bit that some of your influences were Goldsworthy and Richard Serra. And so you started in ceramics, had this sort of inspiration of working with sculpture, and then left kind of all that behind and have delved into the glass.
Yeah, I think that I was always working kind of installation and sculptural with the ceramics work. I did a little bit of the throwing pots on the wheel and things like that, which is totally valid and really entertaining and fun. But I just wanted a little bit more, and I wanted it to take up a little bit more space as well. And I think that's my attraction to Serra and Goldsworthy, like we talked about, is that their works are monumental in size. And I think it was a piece that Serra did at the Guggenheim in Spain, where his just gigantic metal pieces were jam-packed into a gallery space, and there was almost no room to walk around. And I just kind of like how the size or the scale of those pieces really kind of affects the viewer. I've thought for a while that my recent works, works in the past couple of years, as well as the works for the Invisible Cities show, might actually be small models of something much larger. I don't know if that's entirely true, but I could definitely see getting bigger in the future.
I see that in the Eight Blocks piece, mm-hmm. which how is that a little bit different than the Again piece? Can you?
Well, the Eight Blocks, just for the viewers, is actually a freestanding sculptural piece, self-supporting, made up of eight components that were all cast in a kiln. And the Again is more of a wall piece, kind of two-dimensional, but filling up quite a bit of volume at the same time. I think that actually the Eight Blocks is a nice step towards getting something bigger and more involved, taking up more space. But even still, I would like to go more human scale.
And that's interesting when we think about cities, because one of the things that you said about sort of contemplating our relationship to cities was this idea of the city controlling you, and just the overwhelm.
Yeah, I think that cities definitely control us. There's certain times of day where we can move about very freely and stay kind of on task and on schedule. And there's other times of day where it's completely out of our control. And I'm not just talking about traffic, but other people have different ideas of what we're supposed to be doing. And sometimes you don't really have much choice in the matter.
So at the gallery, they knew they wanted to do a show on the book Invisible Cities. And then all you, Richard, Jeffrey, and Carrie, were invited to make pieces. But you had said that you were already on this track of thinking about the places that we live.
Yeah, we were all kind of chosen to be in the show because our work was closely related to the ideas presented in the book. And when I read the book, it was kind of creepy in the fact that if I was capable of this, I may have been able to write it, because a lot of the ideas that he was talking about, like you said, I was already thinking about kind of this repetition of cities, the cycle of cities, the forms that cities take, and how they change over time. And visually, they all tend to be the same when it comes down to it.
And that's really a theme in the novel, that in between, you know, Calvino will say, in between the lamppost and the corner and the people passing each other, and there, you know, that somehow there is this similar structure when it comes down to it.
Yeah. It's funny you say between the lamppost and the corner, because those are the kind of areas that I'm really interested in the city, structure wise, places that people don't always notice, but they're always there. And a lot of times they're kind of supporting the city or supporting the bridge that we're driving over. And they're really attractive places to me. So I try to pick these kind of elements from the city that are all right in front of us, but often get neglected because they're not beautiful or they're not eye-catching. They're kind of just in your peripheral off to the side. And I kind of wanted to document them and kind of appreciate them at the same time.
So there's something beautiful in something that's utilitarian, and you seem fascinated by details.
Yes.
Which is very much what I imagine glass making. The slideshow that I saw of when you were making the mold, there's a real requirement of detail, and there's a lot of technical considerations. Can you explain for the viewers how does this work? How do we make glass sculpture?
Well, I think attention to detail is an interesting comment, because I think that was the first line on my job description when I applied for my current job. And it definitely holds true in the studio when I'm working as well. Keep in mind that I'm teaching the information that I'm using in a studio all the time.
Because you work at Bullseye Gallery, is also associated with Bullseye Glass Company, and there's a research and education department that is your job.
Correct. The Bullseye Glass Company manufactures colored sheet glass in Southeast Portland. We ship it all over the world. We have a research and education department, which is where I work, kind of teaching classes, developing new classes, and remodeling some older curriculum. And then couple that with working with glass all the time at home, I'm able to kind of pack quite a bit into those classes.
And how are you working with the kiln and the mold? And
for example, the wall piece we were talking about, again, as part of Invisible Cities, that started off working with different materials such as foam, polystyrene, and some styrofoam and some corrugated cardboard and some other handmade papers and different papers and cardboards materials that I kind of find. Using those as model making materials, I'll combine them together to actually look exactly like the finished piece, with the exception of its color. And then once I have my model made, an investment mold, a mixture of plaster, silica, and water is made over the top of that. The model is removed from the mold, and then after figuring out how much glass is required to actually fill that mold once it melts inside the kiln, I can work in a number of different ways to get color where I want it in the end. All of the glass gets loaded into the kiln, into the mold, excuse me. The mold then gets loaded into the kiln, and as long as it's fired properly, travels up to about 1525 degrees. Everything melts together into a solid mass or a form at that point, and then the kiln cools down, usually over the period of a week or so. And the glass is removed from the mold, and I can do a number of things at that point to refine it and take it a little bit further, or maybe it's done.
How do you mean refine it?
Well, sometimes it's a matter of fixing things by grinding edges and making sure everything is nice and smooth and cleaned up. Sometimes I can enhance it by adding more glass to it, putting it back in the kiln, this time not in the mold, but refiring it that way to add some accents or some highlights in certain areas.
So you start off with kind of your response to the novel, like and sketches or notes, and how does it form before you start working with all those materials?
Well, it's usually photographs. I take quite a few number of photographs, keep a big catalog of those at home on my computer, and start printing them off and going through them and kind of picking different elements from those photographs. Maybe it's the texture of a wall here versus the color of a building next to another building and how they're kind of interacting with one another. But I'll take little bits from every photograph and then kind of combine them into one piece, do a few sketches, quick sketches, and kind of continue to sketch as I work with the model-making materials. I don't have to end up with a piece that looks exactly like the original sketch. Things are definitely changing a little bit as I'm working with the materials.
So was there a passage that really inspired some of your work that you could read to us?
Yeah, I do have a couple here that I could share with you.
And again, for listeners, we are talking with artist Nathan Sandberg about the show Invisible Cities, which is inspired by the novel Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities. And we're going to read a passage from the novel.
So this passage is from one of the sections titled Cities and Eyes, the fifth version of that section. And Calvino writes, "From one part to the other, the city seems to continue in perspective, multiplying its repertory of images, but instead it has no thickness. It consists only of a face and an obverse, like a sheet of paper, with a figure on either side which can neither be separated nor look at one another."
See that? So it has a real existential theme, the book. Was that your first reaction after reading it?
I think I take it a little bit more literal than a lot of people. And just thinking about different facades in the city and how once you get past that facade, the front of a building or the kind of surface of a bridge or something like that, they're all kind of the same, kind of compartmentalized buildings cut up into grids where people are going about their routines on a daily basis. And I think the sentence only of a face and an obverse, like a sheet of paper with a figure on either side, which can neither be separated nor look at each other, really kind of relates to glass and the way we work with it, and the fact that we can work on two sides of a sheet and they will be separate from one another, yet they will both be working together to kind of finish that piece.
So that's interesting. So you read it and your mind starts to work with describing it visually.
Yeah.
And glass seems to have this ability to have a dual meaning. So you can kind of experience that sort of visceral experience of walking through the city. But there is this quality of trying to bring out the mundane, our experience of the mundane that I hear in...
Yeah, the areas that aren't quite special to everyone.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And insignificant.
Yeah. So the piece that you did with Carrie, Synchronicity, is... they're wall panels. It's very large scale, and they're small glass pieces wedged there. So how did you guys, you knew you wanted to collaborate on a piece and you were really familiar with each other's styles. How did you approach this idea? How'd you come up with the name?
Well, I'd like to talk just to kind of how we arrived at the piece before the name. We did know that we wanted to work together on a piece. In fact, we tried to get the other two people involved in a collaborative piece, but one of them working and living in the UK and one of them living and working in Montana made logistics pretty tricky, and we didn't have a ton of time at this point. So we decided to go about it ourselves, and I was interested in, again, kind of pushing scale a little bit and getting out of this pedestal size piece or kind of really easily approachable wall sized piece. And so I came to Carrie with this idea that I got from the book of kind of a repetitive repeating cycle that exists in cities in all of our lives, actually, but also exists in the book in the form of the structure that Italo Calvino used to write the book, the order in which the themes repeat themselves amongst the chapters.
Right. So for listeners, there's segments sort of they're very, you know, two pages of cities and desires, cities and names, cities and eyes, and those themes repeat themselves.
Exactly. And a lot of people, scholars, other writers, architects, have all taken a whack at kind of deciphering this code that he used to write the book. And that became really, really interesting to me. So I approached Carrie about making some sort of graph-like wall piece that would be maybe 20 feet long or so. And we did end up right about 30 feet, I think, for this piece. But this regular repeating pattern that would happen over and over again throughout the piece. And my first approach, it was a little bit flat. And she brought up the idea of making a piece that would change based on perspective. So when you see synchronicity at the gallery, you walk straight in the door and it looks very flat because the small glass components are sticking straight off the wall, straight towards you. But as you walk to the left and kind of come around the piece, the whole piece comes into view because you're changing the angle you're looking at it.
And it has a skyline kind of structure. But a really big part of at least my experience of it was the way the light changes as you move around it.
Absolutely. Some of the pieces are very opaque and not letting any light through them. Some pieces are much more translucent. You know, you can kind of see the imagery on both sides of the piece of glass, but not quite. Varies a little bit depending on which theme we're talking about.
How did you choose the ones, cities? You chose thin cities, continuous cities. Were there a particular passage that inspired that?
Well, I did pick cities and names as well. And I did happen to pick a passage from that section that kind of spoke to me.
So we're going to read something from Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities.
So the fourth version of Cities and Names. And yet almost nothing was lost of Clarice's former splendor. It was all there, merely arranged in a different order, no less appropriate to the inhabitants' needs than it had been before. The days of poverty were followed by more joyous times, a sumptuous butterfly. Clarice emerged from the beggared chrysalis, Clarice. The new abundance made the city overflow with new materials, buildings, objects. New people flocked in from the outside. Nothing, no one had any connection with the former Clarice or Clarices. And I like that idea, new people flocking in from the outside. The city's kind of going through this cycle of falling apart and then another prosperous era or time where it was kind of being rebuilt. And so people hear about this city and everyone flocks to it. And that's why one of my words I used to describe the cities and names was kind of a marketing or a labeling, because people hear about it and then everybody kind of wants it. And
like Portland,
there.
A lot of
exactly like Portland.
And how did the experience of thinking of all the New Yorkers, including myself,
and myself,
walking to to Portland? So how did the working on the show kind of get you to reflect on the cities that you've lived in?
You know, I really tried not to do that too much. In my work, I want there to be an element of uncertainty. You don't quite know if it's finished. You don't quite know if it's referencing a specific place. And the truth is, I don't want it to reference a specific place. So in my kind of catalog of images that I've been collecting, I never really say where they are, kind of hoping that I'll forget where they are at some point. Because I do kind of like that generic feel to it, actually. hopefully it doesn't take away from the work. But
well, that's interesting because you want to keep it in the abstract. So we had talked about this idea of people having their own experience of your work, and kind of everyone brings some different view to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think depending on where you grew up, you could have grown up in a small town in rural New York. You could have grown up in New York City. And everything that surrounds you in those towns, visually, structurally, structure of the city, the people and your interactions with them, is all going to kind of come to play, come into your mind when you're looking at a piece that is kind of obviously representative of a city or an urban area. Or maybe a better way to say it is a man-made environment. And I think you're going to consider all of that when viewing the work.
And you get that sense from the show. What can you tell us about how the works, you know, stand together in the gallery? Jeffrey and Richard's piece and Carrie, and how are your styles different?
Well, I think it's interesting that visually our styles are all very different, yet we're all kind of working... at least in this show, and to some extent, a few of the artists usually are working in the same vein. But visually, the works all look very different. Richard, for example, is interested, and he does have an architectural background, both teaching architecture and working as an architect. He's interested in the kind of juxtaposition between the rural environment and then this man-made environment. And his pieces read very, very map-like, or almost kind of, I see a little bit of a timeline in there as well, if I look really closely and think about it quite a bit.
And there's kind of an aerial sense, I think.
There is, kind of a topographic aerial mapping almost.
And then Jeffrey's piece has an interconnected kind of feel.
The piece of his that jumps out at me is the one that we talked about, which is very much resembles a spider web, which you could read into as, you know, the city kind of consuming you and holding you in place and not letting you go anywhere. At the same time, it also looks like a network, maybe a subway map or a network of streets that would be present in almost any city.
Mm-hmm. And how would you describe Carrie's work?
Carrie's is a little bit more difficult. I think she's
difficult to describe.
A little more difficult to describe. Like I said, I haven't quite digested it all the way yet. But I do know that she's interested in kind of the areas that exist in between, or the threshold, or the border where certain cities meet one another, or certain entities meet one another. And
there is a softness more to her pieces, and I don't mean that in a weak way.
I mean
softness in kind of things floating away, you know, kind of almost ephemeral, kind of you're moving through things and there's this experience of them changing so constantly.
Absolutely. And it's interesting you say soft, and then I look at some of the materials she used, such as, you know, a pile of rubbish and discarded building materials.
I guess, yeah, it's something dreamlike to me about the way it's placed. And then the kind of blues that she uses is different from the more dramatic colors in Jeffrey's piece, or the lines that are the kind of focus in Richard's pieces.
Yeah, I think you're right. Hers is definitely the quietest of the group. If you pay really close attention, it's almost like it's not even there sometimes. And I think that's a nice quality to have.
Yeah, it's interesting. The show is really, you know, about kind of glass and working with glass and the possibilities of glass. And what do you see as the future of glass and art?
I definitely see, and have seen for a while, as far as technique goes, kiln forming being the future of glass art. When compared to blown glass, and I'm not saying anything bad about blown glass here, but the forms you can come up with in a kiln are so much more varied than what you can come up with working on the end of a blowpipe in a furnace. And part of that is because we have such precise control over temperature in a kiln. You're kind of forced to work at a certain temperature, when you're blowing glass, and that's extremely hot, about 2,400 degrees.
Wow.
And we can work anywhere between 1,150 and 1,600. And it changes dramatically across that whole temperature range.
I remember you telling me, I'm thinking of synchronicity and dealing with that large scale, and you had challenges just even moving the piece to photograph it. Yeah,
yeah, that piece, when it was finished, is, I believe, 28 feet long by 8 feet tall, included 220 different pieces of glass, which used to be 440 until we fired them together. So there were a lot of logistical challenges, and that wasn't something we had really planned on focusing on in the piece, but it became really important in the end because neither of us have a studio that's big enough to work on anything even a quarter that size, 5 feet by 8 feet. It was actually necessary for me to go back and re-rent my old studio just so we had room to finish this piece. Something like 80 boards were attached to it, and these big wooden frames, and then all the glass. The logistics became really interesting. How are we getting this work to Vancouver to photograph? How are we going to get Carrie's glass to my kilns, because she didn't even have a kiln to work out of?
Mm-hmm.
Keeping in mind that neither of us have a car that could fit any of this work in. So we were renting trucks, renting cars, renting studios. Huge challenge, but
you really had to work with the city, right?
Absolutely. And
transportation is a big part of living in a city.
We had it on the bus one day. No.
And so when you teach about glassmaking, what is it that you want the students to get most from it? What are your biggest challenges as a teacher?
What I want students to get most, first of all, I want them to learn the kind of fundamental techniques and tools necessary to realize what they're trying to achieve. I want them to learn about good craftsmanship and not be satisfied with bad craftsmanship. And I also want to be able to inspire them a little bit by showing them my work and not saying that I'm better than all of them, but just show them something that isn't immediately obvious when you think about working with glass. Everybody knows glass is this really shiny, glossy object, but it can look so different. And I think it's when it gets to that point that it really becomes valuable.
Have you ever gotten injured working with glass? My mind is coming with the kiln and the edges.
In my glass blowing days, which I did do full time for a few years, I ended up with hot glass stuck to my lip.
Wow.
While giving a demonstration. That was a challenge.
Artists sap the sacrifices of the artistic process.
Yeah, it's tough.
I would think that would be one of the greatest challenges, was having the skills down enough that you could have your own creative process to, you know, make whatever is beginning to form in your mind.
And it takes a while to get there. It's not going to happen on your first class or your first year or three even, unless you can really dedicate your entire kind of existence to it. There's a lot of challenges with working with glass.
Well, I learned a lot about glass in the show and was really surprised at all that you could do. And it's a beautiful show at Bullseye Gallery. It's really interesting. And it is kind of like walking through a little city, big city, and over of a city. And it's called Invisible Cities, and it's showing till September 25th. And thank you, Nathan Sandberg, for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks, Wendy.